Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f- So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to Cinematic Universe, the podcast that this week doesn't have a gag because Reese couldn't be bothered to write one. So we're just going to say Happy New Year. I'm your host, Joe Cunningham, and joining me are...
James Hunt.
And Reese Williamson.
So today we'll be doing something a little bit different. We will be discussing the Disney Plus show Hawkeye in its entirety, but we'll be starting off with an episode 6 recap. So if you're a listener on Patreon, this is kind of like your standard season finale recap episode where we'll be talking through the plot points of that. But we're going to spin it out into a main discussion like we'd have on the main feed and kind of discuss the show in its entirety. So, yeah, if you're listening to it on Patreon, you're listening a couple of days earlier. If you're listening on the main feed, you're listening a couple of days later. Or maybe you're a Patreon listener who's just listening to it on the main feed for a bit of a treat. So, so that's what's going on today. We're going to be talking about Hawkeye. But before any of that, I'd like to ask James to explain the comic book concept that I just don't understand. So, James, I have a bit of understanding of this concept from an episode way back when. But I understand that something new is happening at Marvel Comics with Miracle Man. So can you give me a little recap of Miracle Man and what's going on right now?
Just a nice quick précis of Miracle Man. Sure.
So shall I tell you what I remember?
Yeah,
because I think I read some Miracle Man. So Miracle Man was like a golden age, or was it Marvel Man, or there was a different character who was like a golden age character who Alan Moore riffed on when he created Miracle Man.
Well, there was a golden age character called Marvel Man who was basically a UK ripoff of Captain Marvel.
Yes, Shazam, I was going to say Captain he's Marvel. Got yeah. he's a kid turning into a superhero vibe.
Yeah, and the comic was brought back and written by Alan Moore in the 80s under the name Miracle Man, or rather, it changed its name to Miracle Man because of some rights issues, like mainly Marvel being like, we don't want you to publish a comic with the name Marvel in the title. Mm. So they changed the character's name to Miracle Man, and Alan Moore wrote these really good comics, handed them over to Neil Gaiman. They were sort of Watchmen era, you know, deconstructivist superhero stuff. It was very, very good, and then ended up in legal limbo for years when the publisher went bust. Neil Gaiman's run was never finished. Neil Gaiman and Mark Buckingham's run. Until this is the last time we talked about it.
Yeah, there was did the rights get picked back up by Marvel and they were in, like, they announced some kind of intent to finish the series?
Yeah, it was, I think, probably as much as 20 years ago now, Marvel sort of announced that they were going to be, you know, helping Neil Gaiman sort out the rights. They set up a charity to do it and, you know, eventually got to the point where they could, you know, had everyone sweet on the deal, all the legal stuff had been untangled. They republished Alan Moore's issues and then intended to republish and then complete Neil Gaiman's run, and although he is currently working on that. However, this week, they have also suggested at the end of a comic called Timeless, that they will be bringing Miracle Man into the Marvel Universe in some capacity. It's not clear how, but that's a fairly big development.
Am I right in saying that Donny Cates, particularly, who's one of the bigger Marvel writers at the moment, he's this insane Miracle Man fan, and there's some suggestion that he's maybe only still at Marvel writing Marvel comics because he's been promised this Miracle Man, Marvel Man gig as and when they can do it. So this presumably this whatever this is will be, he'll be writing it.
It seems that way, yeah.
Mm. And so. Miracle Man, in terms of where... So my memory of reading some Miracle Man, and some apologies if there are any spoilers here for a comic that I half remember that came out decades ago. But, like, there's some kind of twist, right, that, like, one of the versions of him has turned evil or something? Is that right?
Yeah, there's a young... What is it? Young Miracle Man.
Kid Miracle Man.
Or whatever, I can't remember his name. Kid Miracle Man has
grown up and become
grown up and become corrupted and evil.
Right.
To be fair, they deal with that in the Alan Moore comics.
So what is so what's the kind of status quo of this character, and why would it be interesting for him to be coming back?
This is the thing, right? why would it be interesting for Miracle Man to be in the Marvel Universe? The answer is it wouldn't really. Hmm. They might come up with some good stories for it. The thing about Miracle Man is Marvel sort of has its version of Miracle Man. It's the Sentry, right? Which is like your Superman character who is kind of, you know, mentally ill. And
that was the thing that I kept thinking about when you were talking, was the Sentry. And am I right in thinking that whenever the Sentry has been kind of attempted to be brought into mainstream Marvel continuity, it hasn't really worked?
Yeah.
The Sentry was created in Marvel. You know, the Sentry was a new Marvel character.
What I mean is, rather than doing his kind of high concept introductory story, when they've tried to just make him like another one of the Marvel characters who's around, it loses that juice of why that Sentry series is so exciting.
Yeah, basically, like the Sentry's high concept works for one story, and then it sort of you just get diminishing returns where it's not so good.
And that's one of the comics which that is most memorable for me that you've recommended on this podcast. I really, really enjoyed that, and I've got the edition with the series that Seb wrote for the
Alter Ego?
The Marvel Graphic Novel Collection.
Yes, the Marvel Graphic Novel Collection. So I've got, and I remember I ordered that off eBay, and the edition turned up, and there was Seb's words all over the front of it as well, which was an added little bonus. I guess. Is this just let's keep Donny Cates happy?
I think this is we paid a ton of money to untangle this character from his, you know, legal quagmire. We're not going to leave it on the shelf now, and you know we have good writers who will write stories for us.
Right.
Yeah, you've got you know, you're basically looking here at three quite major comic writing brands. One a newer one, sure, but you know. Miracle Man is basically it's how Alan Moore got famous. How this was the comic that opened the doors that would turn into Watchmen and V for Vendetta and all that sort of stuff. This is his this is his first deconstructing superhero story. That's important. Then you've got the Neil Gaiman of it all, where this is a story that he's been trying to finish for, you know, whatever, 30 years.
Years, yeah. I mean, that's
then you got
for
that
me.
Piece of it, and then you got the Johnny Cates bit, which is if this is a guy that's been thinking about Miracle Man stories for his whole career, and he's I think an exciting, good Marvel writer. There's that piece of it as well. So you just have to, I think the least cynical version of this is obviously Alan Moore won't have any involvement, but you know those are three major writers, and you have to put some kind of trust that that there's something in this character that has drawn these interesting people to work on the character. And maybe, you know, and let's hope that we get that that's what we get at the end of this.
Yeah, okay, for me, the interesting news here really is that if they're going to start using Miracle Men in the Marvel Universe, there's a fairly good chance that means the Neil Gaiman issues, which I believe have been written for quite a while, are close to being drawn. And so that this year is the year that they'll put out those final few Neil Gaiman issues and then, right, you know, bring the character back into circulation with that story finished.
Cool. James, why is this morally okay and different from the Watchmen situation?
Because Marvel bought all the rights legitimately.
Right. That's it. Okay.
No one was hoodwinked here.
No one was.
I mean, in fairness, back in the 80s, the issues that Alan Moore and Neil Gaiman wrote were done under the assumption that the publisher had legally gotten hold of the rights to the character, but it turned out that wasn't actually the case. But they've since straightened it out with the creator Mick Anglo,
okay,
who has also died having sold his character to Marvel.
Right. Okay. So, but we don't,
you know, as far as I'm concerned, this has all been done legit and above board, and reparations were made where it wasn't.
Yeah.
There's a whole interesting side story about Neil Gaiman about Todd McFarlane believing he owned the character for a while when actually he had just published a bunch of trademarks and some original art, but that was all part of what Marvel helped to untangle.
Todd McFarlane too. It's just interesting to me that this character and this brand has wrapped up so many major names in its history. It's just I don't know. There's got to be something there. I don't know what it is. I haven't read any of these comics, but there's something there, isn't there? It's interesting.
I mean, there are no bad characters, right? I'm sure there will be good stories to be told.
There are bad
with Miracle Men. Pastebot Pete.
As a final note before we move on, just because this reminds me, the other thing, obviously, that with what I was alluding to with Alan Moore there is the it feels like a similar kind of, I don't know if I want to say gimmick, but that's the word that's in my head, a similar kind of stunt to what DC pulled with bringing the Watchmen into the DC universe for that big story in the last couple of years. Did that go anywhere? Was that when that finally wrapped up, was it any good? Did people care, or was it just a bit of a fart in the wind?
Reese, have you got any perspective on that? Because
I think basically people didn't really care. I think my memory of it, I read like two issues. I remember thinking it felt like a bit of a Geoff Johns just trying to do Watchmen, but sort of, you know, failing a bit in terms of the style of it. Whereas actually he probably should have just tried to write a Geoff Johns comic. But I think the problem was that there was backlash, you know, basically there was lots of whinging from fans, fine. But then also the story just ended up, it was 12 issues, so it's already long, and it ended up coming out over over like 18 months or longer. And it because it was sort of connected to the current timeline, but it was in the future I think it just, by the end of it, it was all a bit muddled it was supposed to land with. And I think also that times with Geoff Johns just slightly getting transitioned out of his status in, you know, as one of the lead writers for DC stuff. So that was happening at the same time. So perhaps whatever vision he had for the DC comics sort of set up at the end of Doomsday Clock, he wasn't then in a position to make that happen.
I mean, it feels like
classic DC shenanigans.
It feels like Geoff Johns has been soft cancelled as well, right?
Yeah, he's doing something somewhere, right? Does he write any comics anymore, James?
None that I read. Put it that way.
Yeah, I think soft cancelled is right.
Yeah. Okay, so that was the Miracle Man stuff. We're now going to move on to the comic book movie and TV news. We're going to start off with some news on a movie that I have not seen, Spider-Man No Way Home. A few things around this. So obviously we're going to talk non-spoilers for my benefit and no one else's. Mm-hmm. I'm sure all of our listeners have seen this movie.
Me and James have seen it, but Joe hasn't.
I'm still intending to see it.
I've seen it twice.
Yeah, I did. I did not want to have to ring up my daughter's grandparents at Christmas and say, sorry, I can't come to see you because I went to see Spider-Man and now I have COVID. Christmas out of the way, I'm hoping to see it in the next couple of days if I can. And then obviously we will have a main episode coming out on it. But the news around the movie is that it has made an absolute crap ton of money. I think within like its first weekend was already the highest grossing movie of 2021 and 2020. Obviously there's Big Pando in there that you've got to bear in mind, but that's still pretty notable. It then passed $1 billion worldwide after its second weekend. There is talk that Sony are going to run a Best Picture campaign for it at the Oscars, and then kind of all kinds of speculation about where the franchise goes from here and whether it's going to be in the MCU, whether Tom Holland's going to be coming back. And I think after this performance, the answer to all of that will be, yes, Tom Holland is coming back. Yes, Spider-Man will remain to be in the MCU because, shit, look what this has done financially.
Why mess with the formula?
Yeah. Thoughts, is this let's go through those in reverse order. Future of Spider-Man in the MCU. Happy for Spider-Man to continue with Tom Holland and for it to be an MCU thing?
I don't see any reason to argue against that.
Yes, and this one's hard to talk about because of the plot of the movie, so
yeah,
but I will say yes excited. Yes, good.
Best Picture campaign. Give me your thoughts. Is that nonsense?
Absolute nonsense. No chance.
I'm not as no chance. I mean, I just think that people really love this movie. I'm not critics, but normal people love this movie.
I mean, it hasn't done bad critically, though, has it? It's not been
100%.
Yeah.
But like, what Oscars are we talking about here?
Well, no, hold on. You've got. Don't forget, you have an enforced. There has to be 10 Best Picture nominees this year. That's a change from last year. Mm-hmm. So there will be 10 nominees. You've got stuff. You know, I think a lot of people are looking at West Side Story as kind of an obvious
flop.
Choice for, like, oh, it'll be a big hit,
yeah.
Big Hollywood Spielberg. The numbers, and then it's just been a bit of a bomb so far, at least. And I don't know. I could definitely see. You know, a campaign, you know, because remember, it's photodrawn by people that work in Hollywood, and this is a good news story for lots of people, lots of employees in Hollywood, the amount of money that this movie's made.
Yeah.
You've got the kind of Omicron stuff, like turning some, you know, making people feel a bit bummed out once more about this whole industry, you know, right now in this moment. And I could see a scenario where in a month or so, or when ballots are going in, you know, enough people go, hey, listen, I didn't, you know, it wasn't my favorite movie of the year, but I'll put it on my ballot for Best Picture somewhere. I'll put it at 8 or 9. And
yeah,
all of a sudden, enough people have done that, it can break through that list. And then I'm not saying it's got any chance to win that award. And I'm not saying it's got any chance to pick up anything more than, I guess, a couple of technical awards, probably, right? Maybe, who knows, a sound, obviously visual effects. I'm not saying it's got any chance for any of the other ones, but that scenario I could see, and I could see it breaking into the 10.
And there does tend to be a blockbuster. You're right that, well, not a blockbuster, but a movie that has done well financially. And yeah, maybe there's room in there for Dune and Spider-Man. Maybe. Mm-hmm.
Two Zendayas.
I was going to say, good news for Zendaya.
I think it leaves you. I just think the movie. I mean, I've seen it with my friends and with my family as well, my younger sisters. And I've just seen it with, you know, without. My view is a little different from them, but I just feel like there's something. It's just really is. It really makes you feel good, I think, coming out of it. A lot like normal people will leave feeling really good about what they've just seen and about films. And I just think if there are enough Academy voters that connects with, that shouldn't be discounted. Whereas actually something like a West Side Story or a Dune, that those endings are a bit more complicated, I think.
And to tie this then into the money side, because I do think that the money more than anything is the reason why, why this is being talked about. I can't lie. From looking at the box office of Spider-Man No Way Home since it's been released, it'll be really interesting how the industry reads it, you know, from an Oscar point of view, because you can say from one perspective, okay, this is the success story. The flip side of that is it has trampled all competition to the point that, you know, West Side Story is an enormous flop, partly because of Spider-Man. Nightmare Alley basically
doesn't exist,
couldn't get started. And then you look at, okay, Spider-Man in its second, third weekend of release is grossing seven times the amount that The Matrix Resurrections is. Yeah, that's another blockbuster. The King's Man made next to no money. Sing 2, a kid's movie, is, which, you know, the first one was really successful, is doing okay. But particularly that first weekend that Spider-Man came out, it made in the US $260 million. Its next closest competitor was Encanto, which made $6 million. And then after that, you've got West Side Story at 3, Ghostbusters Afterlife at 3, Nightmare Alley in its first week of release 2, House of Gucci 2. And
it's staggering.
Yeah, and I say this with the caveat that I like this kind of shit. You know, I do like Marvel movies. But I mean, it really does feel like there is a chance of this kind of, you know, dystopian cinema future where, you know, mainstream cinema are Disney movies, and then there is an art house, and there's nothing in between. Because if Steven Spielberg remaking West Side Story can't make a dent, then, you know, there's just huge swathes of movies, of types of movies, that won't get made anymore for theatrical distribution.
It's tough, like, though, isn't it, right? Because I don't think it was pure marketing that got people into the cinema. It's not like Disney crowded out the idea. It was that people were excited for this movie and it turned out to be really good.
I mean, a couple of things there. West Side Story, I won't touch on that. The Matrix, like, they just fucked up. That almost speaks to the big mistake that Warner Brothers made of that crazy commitment to release every single movie on HBO Max.
Yeah, definitely. Day.
That was just a mistake.
I couldn't believe the numbers for Resurrections when I saw them.
After having made that mistake, they should have moved the date. I mean, the idea that Matrix comes out a week after Spider-Man, that's a mistake. That was a bad release date. They're both basically nostalgia plays for a similar audience. Yeah,
and to be clear, I thought Resurrections was a really great film and I enjoyed it a lot. But had I been going to the cinema once, there's no question that would have gone to Spider-Man.
But the other thing is, I think this Spider-Man movie is a special case. It's not sort of, you know, because if you look at some of the other Marvel releases this year, they haven't done this. You know, the other Spider-Man movies didn't do this. I think this is a bit of an exceptional thing with the nature of it, and that point as well.
You say that, though, but the US box office currently, the top five, let's do the top 10 for the year. Spider-Man No Way Home is number one. Shang-Chi is number two. Venom is number three. Black Widow is four. All of those beat out Fast 9, which is five. Eternals comes in at six. Then Bond at seven. And then it's A Quiet Place, Free Guy, and Ghostbusters Afterlife. Like, the Marvel movies are outperforming other blockbusters now.
But they're outperforming other Disney movies as well, though.
Yeah, but I guess Disney has the stuff that it was having great success with at the cinema prior to this. They're now, you know, they're dropping Cruella onto
streaming,
yeah. onto streaming. Like, would Cruella be up there in the top 5 or 6 if it, you know, if it wasn't for if it wasn't for Disney Plus? I don't know.
But there is. I will make another point. You know, from that list you just given. If those, let's say, those movies didn't exist or went streaming day and day or all got pumped next year or something, you know, actually. What the cinemas go out of business?
Yeah,
you know, like you kind of, you, on one hand, you're saying at this dystopian future where it's just the Disney movies that get people to cinemas, and then there's art house movies. Well, sure, but if we're in a different reality where they aren't this level of success, maybe cinemas are, you know, maybe cinemas don't exist.
Because yeah, nothing's
driving people out to cinemas. So,
it's really, you know, difficult to track because of COVID, right?
Sure,
that makes it really complicated. But then I would say, okay, let's look back to 2019, the last year before COVID. You have number one, Avengers Endgame, becoming the record-breaking release of all time. Number two, The Lion King. Number three, Frozen 2. Number four, Spider-Man Far From Home. Number five, Captain Marvel. Number six breaks things up with Joker, but is a comic book movie, another studio. Seven is Disney. It's Episode 9, Rise of Skywalker. 8 is Toy Story 4. 9 is Aladdin. And then 10 is Jumanji, The Next Level. And that's worldwide, by the way. So that's, you know, that's 8 of the top 10 of Disney movies. As something like 7, you know, everything's a franchise. It's... Yeah, I just, when you're hearing some of the conversations around the edges of cinema, and, you know, like a filmmaker like David Fincher talking about finding it difficult to find funding to get a movie out. I don't know if it's the fault of the superhero movies, and I don't actually think it's a thing to apportion blame to, but I do worry that when we go to the cinema in the future, basically you're gonna watch something that costs either less than $5 million to make or more than 200, and this is coming out of the other side of the pandemic. So it's not pointing fingers, because yeah, I think you're right. Right now, would that $280 million or whatever it is that Spider-Man took in the US, would that have gone to West Side Story and Nightmare Alley instead? No, I don't think so. But some of it would have done. Some of it would have done.
You know, the age of superheroes, it will end at some point, I think. I wouldn't be willing to predict when that would happen. But you know, it might be that in 20 years we look back and we lament. Oh my God, remember when they used to make, you know, $200 million superhero movies 20 years ago? That was cool. So perhaps rather than doomsay the future, let's. You know, try. Hey, listen, the three of us can't actually control any of this stuff. So, you know, again, I think about my family's faces when we left Spider-Man, and that sort of joy that they had in the movie, you know, without my kind of cynical eyes through it. There was nothing this year that had offered them that at the cinema, and they would, you know, yeah, that's it's just undeniable. And perhaps we're too in the coalface to see it through normal people's eyes. But people, just the Spider-Man movie in particular, people just love this movie. People love it.
Like, the thing I would say about Spider-Man, right, is that people who haven't seen the previous two are telling me they want to go and see it because they're interested and because they've heard good things.
Yeah.
Like, people, I think my brother, like, waited for Shang-Chi on streaming, like, I don't think watched. I definitely didn't watch Eternals. Didn't watch Black Widow. But you know, you get people saying like, "Oh, I'm going to see that one."
Yeah, my wife said to me that she wanted to see it, and I was like, "But you didn't watch the last one." She went, "Oh, didn't I?" So I was like, "Right, okay."
I mean, the thing for me is that this is doing sort of Endgame type money.
Hmm.
Yeah,
because it's got a sort of Endgame type event around it, and people were just ready for that. I'm mostly out of anything, the thing I take away from this is, oh good, those people still are coming to cinemas. Because my predictions for box offices post-pandemic were a lot grimmer than this. I was like, they're never going to make a $100 million superhero movie again, because it's just never going to make that money at the box office. But
and turns I think, out you know,
it look, is possible.
If you look at the Marvel slate next year, like, you know, again, this is, I reckon we're 2 or 3 years away from an MCU movie performing like this. This is a sort of an aberration, you know, a kind of movie that happens every 5 years. And it just so happens that the Avengers Infinity War and Endgame 1, 2, we kind of, you know, that was only a few years ago. But these are special cases. These movies were the ones in the conversation here. And next year, I don't think you're going to get $1 billion for Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness. But hey. I've been wrong before.
Hey, but let's talk about Doctor Strange and the Multiverse of Madness.
That was a segue, by the way. Yeah.
I did think it was really funny how literally the moment that you would have had enough time to watch the final episode of Hawkeye, it was, and here is the new trailer for the next Marvel thing you should be interested in. It's Doctor Strange mm-hmm. and the Multiverse of Madness. I wonder whether now, rather than like it being tied for them, for Marvel, rather than it being tied to new releases, it's like, look, we can only build hype for so many projects at one time. So let's let that thing finish before we put a trailer out for that thing. It's not, okay, we're 3 months out, we're 2 months out. It's, we can build hype for X amount of things at a time, and now that one is gone, here is this one.
Joe, yeah. Do you know where the trailer for Doctor Strange 2 first aired?
Oh, well, yeah, I'm presuming in front of Spider-Man.
No, it's actually the final post-credits thing for Spider-Man.
Oh,
there's
right,
no second post-credits scene, it's just the trailer for Doctor Strange 2.
Weird. I guess not. Weird,
I mean, that was it was an exciting time to see it. I was a bit like, I literally just finished watching Spider-Man. Let me think about that before I start thinking about this.
That is, but also, you know what? That is hilarious. Good trailer. For anyone that accuses Marvel projects of just being trailers for the next thing they're releasing, they literally drop a trailer on the end. Oh, I don't want to watch a trailer at the end of a movie.
Right.
Well, now you don't have to. You can just leave after the mid-credits scene when you see it, Joe. We've done you that favour.
Yeah, that's good. Yeah. So the Doctor Strange trailer dropped, and I guess what surprised me most, guys, was that it felt as much like a Doctor Strange sequel rather than another thing. Like, I thought the fact that, I mean, but this was my fist punch moment for it, the fact that Chewie was there in it with his new haircut, I was like, oh, okay, right, so we are continuing on from the threads in the first
film.
we are picking up
that thread, yeah.
Rather than just throwing all of that away and going, we do multiverses now.
I was going to say, I do wonder how much of that is going to be in the film and how much is going to be, let's get this out of the way in the first 10 minutes.
Yeah. A little bit Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Let's get all of our plot stuff done now. So in this trailer, we get Wanda coming in, and there is a scene that made me giggle where he walks up to her and she goes, oh, you hear about that thing? And he goes, nah, I don't care about that thing. Westview, what are you talking about? Oh, it was a thing that happened on Disney Plus. I'm a movie actor. I'm not interested in your Disney Plus nonsense. I'm here for different reasons. I obviously think it's going to follow up on some of the threads from WandaVision, particularly the kids, and her new power set. But I don't think the events of WandaVision are going to be anything more than kind of like first acts. Let's put down the plot points.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
How
should they be?
Did they use the word multiverse in WandaVision? I can't remember. At the end, in the finale?
There's Nexus of Realities stuff there, isn't there, certainly?
Sure.
Yeah. But yes, yeah, so I think that's the main thing that we're setting up here is that wanders along for the adventure, and we obviously know that her MO is the kids. She's wearing her cool new costume. Wong's around, Mordo's around, and then I thought was that we have got some kind of like dark Doctor Strange stuff that really feels like it is hewing quite closely to that What If episode. And I do wonder whether this movie was originally supposed to come out before that What If episode.
I mean, it certainly makes you wonder, doesn't it? Whether that What If episode was intended to be backstory for a character who appeared in this movie.
And if we...
Because remind me, how does What If leave the evil Doctor Strange?
It leaves the evil Doctor Strange in his own little reality bubble.
Until he returns the finale, semi-heroic sense in the finale.
But then how does it leave him in the finale?
He just helps out.
But he's around in his universe again? In the finale? At the end of the finale?
Doesn't everyone go back to their own universe at the end, maybe?
Or does he stay in the Nexus of Realities, maybe? I can't remember, actually. We should re-watch this before we watch Doctor Strange.
No, that's just what they want.
That's what they want, yeah, they got us.
I'm sure that this is the character from that cartoon, which by itself is interesting. Because also, I'll just throw it in here now. I put in one of the news stories that there's a Captain Carter comic book, you know, just comic book. But I think that again, that sort of both these bits play to what we talked about with What If, which is, you know, that maybe the likelihood now is actually much higher that all this stuff finds its way into live action in various ways, which I guess is cool. I don't know. Is it cool? Sure. Are we excited if this movie is? Yeah, you know, I wonder who the villain is in this movie. Is it Dark Doctor Strange? Is it Mordo? Is it Wanda? It's sort of, I feel like we know less now than we did before the trailer dropped.
What
on what the story is? You know, what's the story? Who's the bad guy? What's happening?
Or just if it's Doctor Strange, full stop. That would be cool. Mordo would
certainly be on brand.
Mordo, the religious zealot, who's like, you keep fucking with this stuff. Stop fucking with it. I need to stop you. And I have dreadlocks now. The America Chavez is in this trailer as well. We don't know much about the character in this, so we can save that talk for probably when she gets a bigger spotlight in the second trailer. Someone I didn't see a huge amount of. Is a tentacle guy. Someone I didn't see a huge amount of was Sam Raimi.
Yeah, he got like bodied a bit, didn't he? Not even something in the text, you know, from the director of, I don't know, Spider-Man 2?
Yeah, right. From the director of the Spider-Man films.
Yeah, the director of friggin' Evil Dead. The director of Oz the Great and Powerful. Come on.
Trumpet the director in their movies, right?
Yes, his name wasn't there, but did you see much Sam Raimi in this trailer? Just looked like another Marvel thing to me.
Yes, 100%.
To the point that another bus is being flung down a street. Let's call it with the buses, Marvel.
Yeah, we'll see. I mean, I guess it's to preserve surprises, but I found it interesting that Marvel haven't put Raimi out to do any interviews for Strange or really for Spider-Man now at this moment. But there are those rumors that, you know, what if the Strange reshoots are sort of so extensive that maybe Raimi, you know, maybe is Raimi particularly in charge? You know, was he ever in charge, right? Isn't it? It's Feige and it's Alonso and it's the EPs really that are running the show. But I kind of wonder if, again, they don't mention him. It doesn't feel very Raimi-esque, you know, and he definitely is a director with a visual style, you know, always quite a set sense of a visual style. Yeah. But, you know, but also it's a teaser trailer. It's a teaser trailer that drops at, you know, as we've discussed, at the end of the Spider-Man movie. So perhaps, you know, if there's a film that maybe they cut a trailer that is a good follow-up to what you've just seen, the style of the Spider-Man movie you've just seen, and there's lots of other Raimi stuff that they're holding back for a February trailer, you know. Who can say?
Yeah, I do think the first Marvel trailers at the moment do tend to be pretty poor and non-plot specific, so yeah. Let's move over to another Spider-Man film. We got the first teaser for the Spider-Verse sequel, which we now know is going to be called Across the Spider-Verse, brackets, Part 1. So, a sequel, a title that's riffing on a Beatles track, so all the old white dudes like me will still be interested. I'm really hopeful for this movie based on the first one. I don't think this showed us a huge amount other than it's still going to look really distinct, and the characters we like from the first one are coming back. But yeah, I you know,
some of the characters. No, yes. Peter B. Parker in this trailer.
Yeah, well,
he'll be in it, right?
Spider Gwen and Miles are back, and you know, we like them. And yeah, I don't know too much more to say about this other than I was a little bit worried by the part one, thinking like, are they trying to be too ambitious with this? But like, I probably shouldn't advise the people who made the first one of these movies to be less ambitious. So,
although it's different, directors, right?
Yes,
isn't that right?
Yeah, that is right. I think
animation directions are sort of different beasts, though, right? There were three directors on the first movie.
Yes,
because it is Lord and Miller again with the script, and they're producing as well, I presume. So if that's a big creative kind of leader on the first one, then that's a good sign.
I think these big animated movies are by their nature just more collaborative. It's very it's a lot more you know, I don't think that Lord and Miller have the stamp on the first Spider-Verse movie that they do on a lot of their work. It doesn't feel as much of a Lord and Miller join as, you know, most of the other stuff they produce, but you know, their involvement I think is always a positive.
One thing I will say, you know, back to the money of No Way Home of it all, I do wonder and worry. You know, Sony have always shown a slight, you know, a desire to chase the Spider-Man dollar. You know, whenever possible, and I sort of wonder with the huge No Way Home numbers. And the, you know, the part one of this sequel, whether, and obviously you've got, you know, Venom 2 did pretty well, Morbius comes out in Feb. You kind of just wonder, you know, you've got the Feige doing what he wants to do, sure, but, you know, Amy Pascal will surely now be, the pressure will mount for just more, you know, and I wonder whether that will have its detriments. Although, you know, yeah, maybe Morbius will stink, but so far, so good, right? Maybe. Venom movies are fun. We like all the Spider-Man MCU use. Spider-Verse is incredible. So far, so good. But maybe next year is when Morbius stinks and this movie feels, you know, feels overextended. And they announce, so, yeah, and we're going to do Amazing Spider-Man 3 with Tobey Maguire. And we're doing, you know, we're doing a Sinister Six movie and all this kind of crap comes back around. I don't know.
The thing I thought when I saw part one was that, weren't they, at one point, they said, we're developing a Spider-Verse sequel and also a Gwen spin-off.
Oh, yeah, I think there was.
And I think kind of what happened was someone went, why would we make a Spider-Gwen spin-off that would do worse? Why don't we just make two Spider-Verse movies?
Mm. And maybe make her more central.
Yeah. So I think maybe like a Spider-Verse Part 2 has a more prominent role for her, or maybe she's more prominent overall in the story. I feel like it's going to be more of a focus on her and Miles.
of course, played by, you know, the wonderful Hailee Steinfeld, who we'll talk about later.
Absolutely. And then let's talk about the final trailer that was released over the Christmas period. This was The Batman with our bats. And, this is kind of more of what we saw the first time around, even though what we saw the first time around was like 3 weeks worth of footage. I'm struggling to get hyped for this movie because I'm not seeing like something distinctly different from what I've seen from Batman before, but I guess for a lot of people that won't be a problem. But are you guys seeing it? Are you guys seeing the take? Because I'm not yet.
I think expecting a distinct take on Batman is asking for something more than the cinematic division of Warner is interested in.
But are you excited for this movie? Is there like?
No, but I'm never excited for Batman movies, so I'm sure it'll be fine. It's a Batman movie. It's so hard to get wrong.
I was a lot more excited after the first. I thought the first trailer just had a lot of, you know, if we want to talk about, we just talked about the Strange trailer and how it all looked a bit boring. I thought the first Batman trailer just looked really sort of cool and interesting and filled with more visual stuff than these movies normally have in them, or at least in the trailers. And this, I didn't feel like this brought this further things along anymore on that. And but also similarly, I didn't feel like I got a more sense of what the plot was. So yeah, I'm kind of with you, Joe. I was properly excited by that first trailer, and this one, it's just a slightly more boring trailer, really. But the one, I don't know about you, James. Did you read? Either of you read the Tom King Batman run?
Bits of it,
very start of it.
that whole run is one of my favorite recent comic book runs from either publisher. And there were just a couple of scenes in this trailer that I thought was perhaps referencing the Batman Catwoman emotional spine that is so important to that series. And I just back in my head, I wondered, if that is an influence on this, you know, which I don't think that anyone said that it is, but if that is, then okay, that could be interesting. And, you know, and actually the Batman Catwoman dynamic hasn't, if you know, Joe, you back to sort of what could be new about this, that even though we've had two versions of Catwoman before and obviously a solo film that is great, that's a dynamic that probably could do with some, you know, that is worth exploring. And perhaps that's this movie, perhaps. Yeah.
I guess the thing that I keep coming back to with it is because I like the Robert Pattinson casting. I'm kind of interested to see if he has got anything interesting to do with the character. I think it's just Matt Reeves is someone who I just feel like I'm constantly being told he's interesting rather than necessarily connecting with his movies. I don't know. I think I'm probably in a minority opinion there, but he's never really coalesced for me as a filmmaker, and I don't know if I am super hyped for the Matt Reeves take. You know, less so than I even would have been for when this was going to be a Ben Affleck Batfleck movie. You know, when he was going to write and direct it.
Yeah, but I'd rather, I'm more excited for Matt Reeves' take on Superhero X than John Watts' take on the Fantastic Four, you know?
Yes, that is definitely true, yes.
So there's, and I really like those H movies, and those are, for me, a very interesting, like, sort of modern take on a franchise that felt like it might be hard to do, in modern times, and those movies are great.
We are going to need to move on now because I don't want to get James started on those Apes movies. I think probably just a couple of little bits to mention as we transition from the news. There's been a HBO Max Penguin spin-off series confirmed.
For fuck's sake.
Colin Colin Farrell getting that money, I guess. They're obviously not turned off enough by having to sit in that makeup for longer.
Jesus
Christ. Shang-Chi 2 has been confirmed, which isn't a surprise. And then I think one just to keep on the back burner, we'll probably discuss in more detail on our next main feed episode. There are questions around what is happening with Wakanda Forever. We obviously had our conspiracy theories the first time around. Is that film going to be released this year and meet its release date? I would question, but we'll dig into that at a later date. So that was this week's comic book, movie and TV news. We will move on now to our discussion of the series finale and then the broader series of...
If you thought the only way to get a more defined jawline with natural-looking results was through surgery, think again. Juvederm Volux XC is a non-surgical injectable gel filler that improves moderate to severe loss of jawline definition and can help you achieve natural-looking results with little downtime. Even better, this improved definition lasts up to 1 year with optimal treatment. No maintenance required. Improve jawline definition for a smooth, sculpted look with Juvederm Volux XC. For important safety information and to find a licensed specialist, visit Juvederm.com. That's Juvederm.com. Not for people with severe allergic reactions, allergies to lidocaine, or the proteins used in Juvederm. Common side effects include injection site redness, swelling, pain, tenderness, firmness, lumps, bumps, bruising, discoloration, or itching. There's a risk of unintentional injection into a blood vessel, which can cause vision abnormalities, blindness, stroke, temporary scabs, or scarring. Talk to a licensed specialist to find out if it's right for you.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Okay. Okay, welcome to a bonus Patreon edition of Cinematic Universe where we discuss Hawkeye. we're talking episode 6 of Hawkeye first, which we'll use as a springboard to get into all of our kind of more big takes on the series. We thought we'd combine this into one, partly because of the delays over Christmas with recording it, and also. I don't know about you guys. I feel like there aren't as many kind of like big stand back and assess the series takeaways at the end of it. I kind of feel like of all of the Marvel shows, this was the one which it was what it was from episode 1 through to episode 6. It kind of I thought it was fairly consistent. I thought episode 2 was weak, but apart from that, I thought it was fairly consistent start to finish. And in spite of a couple of revelations from Marvel-y stuff in there, it didn't really deviate too much from what I thought it was going to be after episode 1.
No, I think that's fair.
I think that's fair. I think it makes it, a bit less of a roller coaster than some of the other shows. At least, personally for me, after episode two,
for good and bad.
Sure, yeah. I think for me, more good. I think I just knew what I was going to be getting, and there was therefore a nice consistent level of enjoyment that I expected and received, and in a sort of a nice transactional way, walked away satisfied, including for the finale. Whereas I just remember feeling much more forlorn. No, that's way too wanky a word. More annoyed and pissed off at like the Loki finale, or in some ways the WandaVision finale. I mean, although I think you guys like that more than I did. Or whereas this was like, yeah, okay, bish bash bosh. bit of Hawkeye.
I think the, to go back to WandaVision there, which I still do think is the most successful of these Disney Plus shows, I think the finale was a little bit more by the numbers than I wanted it to be, but I thought it nailed its big emotional moments, which was... and it kind of it nailed its final Wanda and Vision scenes, which was important.
Sure.
I think this feels closer to the Falcon and the Winter Soldier finale in that it is essentially one big fight centered around a building in New York. And I think it felt like it had more plot stuff to pay off. In reality, it didn't. I think James and I got caught up in the standard doing a little bit of over speculation and over trying to explain what it was going for. But I think for its lack of kind of plot that it was doing in its final episode, I think it also kind of lacked kind of the big cathartic emotional moments because I just don't think the series invested strongly enough in them as we went along, and I don't think it grappled enough with its central conceit of is Hawkeye a good guy. Go on, James.
Well, go on, you finish.
I think that the answer in the finale is he wasn't a good guy for that specific 5-year period. He did all of the bad things that you thought he did, but we like him now, and we liked him before, and you didn't actually see any of that, so don't worry about it.
This is the thing I felt right, was that I got to the end of the story, and I sort of thought, they nailed the plot beats they were aiming for, which was like, we need to introduce Kate Bishop, and we need to make her, you know, Hawkeye's understudy or whatever, but the actual emotional component of the storytelling, they didn't pay much more than lip service to. And I just spent the whole finale thinking, like, I don't really care what happens here. It feels like a ball is rolling downhill and I'm sitting there going, well, at some point it's going to reach the bottom.
I think that, and Reese, it'd be interesting to get your take on this, given that James and I have been discussing this on Patreon week in, week out. It felt for me like the Clint stuff was just, it was flawed from its conception because they wanted to do all of the Ronin stuff. And I think that, you know, because that was convenient on a number of plot levels previously, that explained where Clint was when he wasn't in Infinity War. It gave him a different edge in that movie. It gave him the emotional catharsis at the end of Endgame.
It's a new action figure to sell.
Yeah, exactly. So all of that stuff was set up over to the side. And then doing this series felt like it had to pay that off. And also it's convenient because it gives Clint this kind of reckoning with his past kind of stuff. Whereas at the same time, we're doing the introducing Kay and her kind of seeing him as some aspirational mentor. I kind of feel like you could take the Ronin stuff completely out of it and get the good part of the resolution of the finale, which is Clint learns to be a mentor. Kate learns to be a superhero. He kind of has that like dad-like pride in her. All of that is resolved and just ignore the Ronin stuff or even if you need to just retcon it completely, just retcon it because it doesn't reconcile with this character and the character they're depicting in this show and a character who gets forgiven by everyone around him. I just don't think the Ronin stuff tracks in this series at all.
But I guess why they need it, if you're looking at it as a sort of a puzzle board, you know, and this was what we talked about this before the show ever aired, that the comics, this comic story they're adapting, the kind of Hawkeye is this sort of slightly grumpy mentor to Kate Bishop, that's in place because of the sort of single man Hawkeye bit in down in the dumps version in the comics, whereas you just needed a stronger motivator for him at the beginning of the series to do any of this, right? If you've got him, Family Man Hawkeye, forget the Ronin stuff, and Kate Bishop's there, and like I just don't think he would. That's not enough of a motivation to help her, and that's the tricky bit, right? How do you? I wonder whether that's in the writers' room. That's what they came to. He needed a really strong motivator to kind of do the MacGuffin stuff that happened to also involve Kate Bishop, and they got to Ronin. But I mean, I agree with you, but I just don't know how. Yeah, I'm struggling to square that circle without something.
But you know that, and this is part of the challenge for all these Marvel projects. That you know, when you're sitting down to make a Hawkeye TV show, you have the baggage that you're coming into it with. You're having the baggage of what you need to set up and what you need to leave by the end of it. And I think they do a much better job with the end of it than the start of it, if you know what I mean. They do a much better job with the stuff that they are that they're pumping out of this series to be used in future stuff. So obviously I think Kate Bishop, Hayley Steinfeld is a huge success, and I think actually the relationship that they've established here that I think is probably going to be the most fertile ground in the future of the MCU is Yelena and Kate. And you know, they got all of that stuff right. And had some fun along the way. It just, I just don't think I can hold this up there as, you know, the best Disney Plus show. And, you know, I would put it above Falcon and the Winter Soldier, and I'd put it above Loki, but those are two series I didn't really like. And I think that this one kind of, it was fine, I thought, throughout. It was fine, one bad episode, one really good episode, and then four that just kind of were like, yeah, they're okay.
The thing I keep coming back to is, does Marvel just not know how to make TV? Because we were promised, like, oh, these are going to be good, not like the Netflix ones. And actually, they're a lot closer in tone and in resolution to the Netflix shows.
I mean, obviously, this one has something fairly
sizable. This one has one pretty big connection, yeah.
But it did, before that happened, this felt like the most Netflix showy of them.
Yeah, and the thing I keep coming back to is like they don't work for me as week to week projects. So like I tend not to finish. WandaVision is the exception here, right? When an episode of WandaVision finished, I couldn't wait to put the next one on. Like even though it wasn't all gold, like I was excited episode to episode.
Yeah.
Whereas Hawkeye, I was just like, I feel 5 minutes into the first episode, I just sort of knew where this was heading. Like I feel like they've got a lot of work to do to make these, especially because they're as good as the movies, like to make them match up with that.
And I think as well, so to zero back in on the finale, I think the finales have been universally across the shows kind of some of the weakest stuff they've done across the run of each of those series. Like I would probably have this episode like ranked fourth or fifth of the Hawkeye episodes. The Loki one, obviously it either worked for you or it didn't. Falcon the Winter Soldier finale was a clusterfuck, and WandaVision finale, I think, you know, had some good stuff in it, but wasn't up there with some of the really fun sitcom-y stuff that they were doing earlier on. And it does, you know, the vibe certainly that I'm getting from Marvel TV is we do plot up to the final episode, and then the final episode is an action scene with a coda. Yeah. But there is still lots to talk about in this episode, and we should do that, and we should do that chronologically.
We need to talk about the big white elephant in the room.
Oh my god. Such a big white elephant. So we get our previously on, and then straight away after speculating about whether he would be back or not, how sizable a role he would play in this finale. Vincent D'Onofrio, I think what's the best word? Clomps back in. Wades back in to the Marvel universe to sit down and have a conversation with Eleanor Bishop. I would say, in terms of my expectations for the D'Onofrio Kingpin, I'm glad that it is basically the same depiction, the same performance, that D'Onofrio is still bringing the kind of same ticks to the way he delivers dialogue, and the sense that there is so much more going on below the surface than just this. That he doesn't feel like a standard mob boss, does he? He does have that air of, we should be scared of him because this is not just another bad guy. Like, this guy could go off the rails at any moment. But I thought his use in the episode was a little bit more standard by the numbers. But D'Onofrio was what made Kingpin interesting in this episode more than anything else.
I mean, it certainly wasn't the writing, which didn't do much to acknowledge who he was or why we should care.
Well, they probably want to keep their cards a bit, you know, they're probably not super sure what the plan, well, I say that, they're not, let's presume they don't fully know the plan for him. They don't know, you know, how audiences will respond. How do we square off the stuff that happened in those Netflix shows? How much of that is, do we even think of as canon? There's the Daredevil of it all, which has question marks around it. So I think they probably, you know, the writers of this episode and of this show, getting the wider control, right, probably just about squared that circle of, like, they probably had a list of, hey, here's, you're going to use Kingpin in this, and mm-hmm. here's who's going to play him, but here's what we want to and not to say about this version of the character. Here's this piece of paper here. Do your magic.
Yeah. I think D'Onofrio does do his magic, because so he walks into that first scene. It's a little bit of exposition. I didn't like the resolution of this because it really lets Eleanor Bishop off the hook. So the explanation, the biggest shocker of this entire finale, Kate Bishop's dad is not back. He is in fact dead. Brian Darcy James was cast for one scene.
I'm still not sure he is dead.
I don't believe that either.
But in this series,
season two, he'll be back.
They certainly believe he is dead.
Yeah. He's dead.
Brian Darcy James, you just wouldn't cast. I was just mad.
Yeah,
sorry,
just mad. He's, so he was in debt to the Kingpin. So when he died, Eleanor started working for the Kingpin and is clearly like an important figure in his organization. But she now wants out because her daughter is getting too involved. The moment in this scene that I was like, fuck yes, D'Onofrio's back, is right at the end when his, like, his eye twitches when she leaves. He's like, he's not allowing himself to get visibly angry. You can just see his eye twitching. And I was like, mm-hmm. D'Onofrio's good. D'Onofrio's real good. He's been given absolutely nothing to work with in this scene. He basically just has to be, well, you know, I'm important. You shouldn't be walking away from me. But D'Onofrio brings it. What I couldn't square, guys, why did Eleanor hire Yelena to kill Clint? Does that make sense? Does that make sense to anyone? Why does she care about Hawkeye? Why
isn't it because to stop Kate interacting with Hawkeye?
But that's before has she maybe hired? So maybe Yelena is hired midway through this series. Maybe after they have that conversation.
Yeah.
Okay.
Do I win a no prize?
So maybe she.
We have to conclude that.
Okay, I think I was probably working on the assumption that the Yelena scene at the end of Black Widow was happening kind of months ago or weeks ago, and she's just getting to New York to kill him now. But that would make sense that Eleanor hires him mid series.
And I guess we're also supposed to the Contessa stuff doesn't connect at all with Yelena in this. Like, that's just how she's learned about Natasha dying via Hawkeye, right?
No, I think that's how Eleanor hired her, was through the Contessa, I think.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I think that's the implication, but again, sometimes lining up the post-credit scenes with what happens after is always sketchy, right?
I don't know, did you guys read the news story that apparently the writers of, like, there was no connect, like the Hawkeye writers didn't know, hadn't seen that scene, and the people who wrote the Black Widow scene didn't know that she was going to be in Hawkeye.
Wow.
So it's no shock that they don't fully line up, because the people making them didn't know the other existed.
But anyway, Yelena is because she quite likes Kate, she sends her a whole video of the conversation so Kate can get a download of all of the plot intricacies, which really makes things more expedient for the rest of the episode. There's no like, explain yourself to me, mum. It's, hey, listen to this tape I've got of you. you are bad, and I know that. So that sets things in motion with Clint's like, okay, so we need to, if your mum's involved with the Kingpin, we definitely need to be involved. Let's go get ready. Meanwhile, we're straight back to the Kingpin, who has now had a costume change and is wearing a red floral shirt under his white jacket. Is this a comics costume? It felt like a very specific choice. Which he's not.
Yeah, it is.
And he's not in it in the first scene.
Yeah, it's from the cover of Family Business, Spider-Man Family Business. Is that right?
Okay.
I think.
So that's a.
It looked quite Bill Sienkiewicz-y, I thought.
Yeah. But yeah, that's the only reason where you can explain the character wearing that.
So this is then the Echo Kingpin scene. So Echo, Kingpin, as we now know, is uncle. So Echo has been working for him, and suspects that he was involved in her dad being killed. And so just to square off that circle as well, James, we were speculating about whether Ronan was ever anyone else. I think evidently Ronan was not anyone else. That Clint, while he was Ronin, received a tip-off that the head of the tracksuits was at the car lot, goes there and kills him, and then runs away. So Ronin did kill him, but was probably manipulated into it by someone within Kingpin's organization, and that's come from Kingpin himself, basically.
I see. Okay.
Is that how you guys read it as well? Because there's no implication in this episode that anyone was ever Ronin.
No. So you're supposed to have question marks at the end about who Laura is. Sure, but no, I don't think there's the suggestion.
Supposed to have question marks? Like, a lot of people are going like, "Oh, so it's Laura Mockingbird." I was like, I never got that impression.
I think it's just she was at one point just a SHIELD agent. Agent 19.
Okay.
If you really care about your comics lore, you can go like, oh yeah, maybe she's Mockingbird and she's changed her name and appearance.
So
is there an Agent 19 in? Sorry, Joe. You go.
I don't know. This is discussion for the end of the episode.
So
Kingpin has the confrontation with Echo. She is trying to front it up and say like, oh yeah, no, I'm cool now. I've decided that I'm not going to follow up this Ronin stuff anymore. You were right. And Kingpin sees straight through it and is like, right, okay, so now Maya's turned on me.
That's one of the things I like about the Kingpin, is that he's got no time for deception.
Yes.
Too smart.
I feel like that's something that D'Onofrio could have done more with if those characters had been seen on screen together before that. I get why they held off Kingpin, and I'm sure that they had, you know, limited time with D'Onofrio, and maybe it took a bit of wrangling to get him involved. But I think all of the Echo stuff would have been much stronger if Kingpin hadn't been a secret, if he'd just been another character in the series, and maybe if he is a significant part of the Echo solo series, then it will be better there. But
do you think that still happens?
Yes.
I mean, she is the absolute worst part of the show, in my opinion. And nothing about any second she's on screen makes me go, yeah, I'd like to see a six-episode series about her. I just,
yeah.
I mean, not to be the performance is just so, it's just so flat and boring.
I just think that she, and there's nothing in the
story.
She is the element that feels like a Netflix. She feels like a Netflix supporting character.
Mm. Yes.
And you know, if you it, like, it, and it kind of like a, you know, a cut rate version of the Netflix Elektra, because we don't get to spend the amount of screen time with her that we did with Elektra, and that, you know, that in that series, that is a more charismatic performance. I just think it's Echo doesn't work top to bottom, but I think we probably do still see that series. If I had to guess,
Do you think Daredevil will pop up in that?
I hope so.
100% yes.
Yeah, it does. It does feel like if you're going to bring back D'Onofrio, you're going to bring back Charlie Cox. So, fingers crossed. So after that, we then we watch Clint and Kate preparing loads of trick arrows, which we're going to be seeing lots of later in the episode. Then we then cut to the location of this final fight, which guys is 30 Rock. I did think that must have been an interesting contractual thing for Disney to be like, hey, NBC, Universal, Comcast, can we use your famous New York building as the finale of our episode of our MCU series?
Well, I wonder if they own the building, or maybe, you know, maybe they, you make an agreement with whoever owns the building and they're like, yeah, great, you want to, you know, you want more we can sell some more tickets to the ice skating next year,
because
we 30 Rockefeller Plaza are not owned by NBC. I don't know.
Yeah, or they were just like, you know, this will pay for the lights being kept on this year.
Sure. Yeah.
So yeah, there's a Christmas party at 30 Rock, and Clint and Kate turn up, and they're also at the party with them are the LARPers. And
the LARPers.
Sorry, no, that's the worst part.
Yeah,
that
is the worst part of the show. And then the setup for this is that we've got Kazi with kind of like a sniper trained on the party from the other side of the road. Yelena and Eleanor then both arrive at the party as kind of like extra agents of chaos. And Kazi, I guess, I don't know who his main, whether Eleanor is his main target or whether it's the Hawkeyes or what, I don't know. But he's going to be shooting, and there's going to be nonsense going on at the party. Kate calls out her mum pretty early on and kind of says, like, I know you did all this stuff, and she tries to explain her way out of it. And then Kazi tries to shoot Clint, and then we have chaos at the party and all of the action starts. I think if we go through this kind of fight by fight almost. So there's a lot of chaos to begin with. Clint quickly flushes out Kazi with a smoke arrow, which means he has to leave his perch and kind of get over to 30 Rock to join the fight. And then we get, I think, the one of the most fun elements, which is Kate and Yelena kind of fighting and quipping. These two characters, are you guys on the same page as me? These are two characters who you just want to see share the screen for the next
100%.
5 years of the MCU.
This is the scenes between the two of them in this series feel like properly foundational for a lot of fun to come. Obviously they're both, you know, they both have like definitely kind of humorous, you know, acting chops. So there's all this fun kind of comedic chemistry, but there's also that tension there in terms of their backgrounds, the kind of the Hawkeye of it all, the, you know, them, what Yelena thinks are the Hawkeye. There's a tension there. It kind of reminds me, you know, sort of there's elements of Captain America and Iron Man, that just sort of that mostly quippy dynamic, but with, you know, with tension there, as you know, if we're way back from the first Avengers movie. They're just two top end performers. You know,
it's almost
two,
like
extremely charismatic performers.
The inverse of the Cap Iron Man relationship, where it's like those two are like, we don't get on, we don't have anything in common personality wise, but we respect each other's positions as Iron Man and Captain America and what we bring to the team in that way, that we are going to have a truce and fight together. Whereas these two are like, we should not get on because you're trying to kill my mentor. Our first interaction is you breaking into my apartment to basically threaten me and my entire family. And yet we can't help but kind of like each other. And you can see that Kate is kind of like, I like the stuff with her, like, pulling off the suit, and it's like, did you do that on purpose? And that they kind of both see through each other a little bit, that Kate is, while she's fighting her, she's also trying to impress her. She's trying to prove herself to Yelena as well. And, the back and forth is really fun, and I'm kind of complimenting each other on hurting each other in the fight. And like, I just think that Kate has been really well established as the series has gone on, to like have that scene in the lift where she is fighting not to fight with Yelena, but just to push all the buttons in the lift is is funny. Like that's a great bit. and Yelena's reaction to it as well. It's good. Good stuff.
What I'm learning from this conversation is that I'm so much colder on this series than either of you, because I thought all of the stuff with those two characters was borderline interminable.
Oh, really?
Oh, God.
Especially that mac and cheese stuff in the previous episode.
That's my favourite scene in the whole series.
I just couldn't cope.
I don't always think it's been the most compellingly written. I just think there's two performers there who've got a spark with each other, and
I think they were desperately trying to make some bad dialogue feel sparky.
Oh no,
that didn't excite me for seeing more of it.
Well, bad news. There will be more of that.
What I wanted to see after this show, I wanted to see less of the Marvel TV, not more of those guys.
No, but I'd like to see them on an Avengers team, you know? That's what I want to see.
Yeah, I can imagine that, but it doesn't mean I would ever go back and rewatch this, for example.
I also thought that they did a good job throughout the whole series of playing a lot of Kate's stuff, you know, having a lot of comedy for Kate, but always...
Not undermining her.
But not undercutting her... sort of her abilities, her talents too much. So that feels important, an important foundation for the future, that, you know, she's going to be on the funnier end of, you know, of the superhero characters, but
the comedy with her comes from her being green, that she doesn't know how to be a superhero yet. But then also the flip of that is that she doesn't bring some of the pre-established like superhero ideas to it. And she's like, I'm just going to walk into this building, or I'm not going to fight you now, I'm going to press all the buttons in the lift. I think the Kate stuff has been consistently pretty strong throughout the series. The fight then goes down to the street. Kate has to jump out of a window, and hopefully now we can talk about something that we are going to be universally positive on in this episode, which is Jack.
The swordsman.
Oh,
Who would have guessed at the start of the show that he was going to be the best thing about it?
Yeah, I thought he was kind of like, in the first episode, I was like, oh God, he really feels like a B-C-T-S, like kind of villain that you put into a Disney Plus show, who just like feels like he doesn't belong there. And what they do with the character is basically, I think, kind of perfect. Subvert your expectations and go, no, he's not a crap villain. He's a crap hero.
Yeah.
And he just wants to, like, he's the good version of what they do with the LARPers. Which is to go, let's throw this guy in who has these kind of like pretensions of being in this world, and then have fun with him literally kind of on guarding people outside a skyscraper. And I thought it was such a funny performance. I don't think I've ever seen this guy before,
and he was
he's in Narcos, he was, right, or something like that.
Okay.
I think
he just was very charming. It was a very charming performance.
The thing I loved most about his performance is when you know, in the previous episode where he gets led away, he's like giving a supervillain performance, but that's just who he is. He's like doing this kind of, I was all framed, you know, don't worry, you'll see me again.
It turns out
he's just a good guy.
He's just, I think he's just playing it as a ham, and that really works.
Yeah, yeah.
And yeah, he's the kind of character that I could see that you would bring back in a kind of Disney Plus equivalent of Ben Kingsley way.
Or he'd pop up in exactly, like a, yeah. in a, oh, what was the guy's name? WandaVision, the cop from outside. Who am I thinking of? Randall Park.
Yes.
Like he could pop up in something like that, like just playing a sort of a comedic foil, right? In some other setting.
Completely unrelated to the events of Hawkeye, yeah.
Secret Invasion. He could be like a sidekick to Nick Fury's Secret Invasion.
Yes, great. Let's do that.
I mean, he was my pick for Skrull, so who knows? We might yet see him again.
Okay, I'm going to jump around in the chronology a little bit here because I want to get all of the Kharzi stuff out of the way. Kharzi and Clint fight, and I was like, no, what in this series has convinced us that this should be a fight that is a bother for Clint for even a second?
This is the problem I had with
space aliens.
This is the problem I have with when Kate and Kingpin fight, though, which is that I don't think they really figured out why those characters should be fighting as the climax of the series. It's not like the Kingpin has been the architect of Kate's misfortune here. Like, they just fight because they're in the same room, and that's why Kharzi and Hawkeye fight.
Yeah.
It doesn't feel like there's any emotional catharsis attached to those.
Yeah, it's just I do kind of think that the finale kind of has a Clint problem in the only stuff that we're interested in getting to with Clint is Yelena, right? And so everything else feels like it's spinning its wheels. So him fighting Kharzi, yeah, I've seen him kind of easily dispatch of Kharzi on two or three occasions earlier in the series, so that's fine. You know, Kharzi lands a few blows, and then Clint kind of easily gets rid of him. And then the kind of follow up scene is when Kharzi faces off with Maya, and she kills him. And again, there's just nothing in that scene. Like I think
that, in that scene, right, they're sort of talking as if they were together.
Which I think
was watching
been,
that episode going. I think was been, that was that supposed to be what was happening?
I think it's been really kind of implied,
but not heavily enough for me to care when they reveal it. Right?
Yeah. No. And yeah, when she kills him, I'm like, okay, it's not
good.
Yeah. And again, like that's probably something that for that character should be like this foundational emotional moment. And it just plays like, yeah, it plays like the, you know, like a scene that you can nip to the loo during, you know?
She should have been shooting a gun in the air and going, ah.
So anyway, R.I.P. Kharzi. He's killed.
He never got to wear his mime outfit.
Yeah, no, he never gets to put on the clown makeup. So then Kate is doing lots of fighting of the tracksuits on the street. Jack gets out his sword. That's fun. And then Kate finds her way into F.A.O. Schwartz and onto the piano. I'm not sure why they didn't really do much with it. I thought that could have been a really fun, like if the fight had completely found its way into there, but it doesn't. And then Clint ends up falling out of the building and into the tree. So he's stuck in the tree for half the episode. Very weird kind of returning bit with a CGI, was it an owl?
Yeah.
What's going on there?
I don't know.
you guys didn't see this?
No.
I'll jump to the end. There was a cut post-credit scene where the owl comes and picks up the van that had been sunken.
Yeah,
yeah.
No, that's in the episode.
Oh.
Oh, no, okay. It's the post-credit scene, right?
It's in the episode. It's in the episode.
Yeah, because the post-credit scene is the other thing. Yeah,
I'm talking about that runner in general. why is there a CGI owl?
Yeah.
It just felt very strange to me. Maybe
it's a reference to something we don't get because we're not American.
Yeah, the LARPers all get dressed up and they come and join the fight, which is dumb. And then the kind of the big set piece of the episode is kind of Clint and Kate both find their way to the ice rink and all of the trick arrows come out and they are basically fighting off hordes of tracksuits who are coming to attack them. I thought this was fun, but it also felt like a kind of a watered down version of what they'd done in the third episode. Reese, can you tell me I'm wrong? Did you like this sequence any more than I did?
No, I didn't. You know, Hawkeye in the movies has always, he just has the least interesting sort of power, you know, to watch in fight scenes. He's got a bow and arrow. And they have done a pretty good job, especially in the first Avengers movie, of giving you just giving you enough and it's cool enough. Whereas, you know, we've just had a lot of arrow stuff, obviously, in the show. And at some point you go, it's shooting an arrow. And this one has a gimmick.
Can this problem be solved by shooting an arrow? Let me guess.
Yes, exactly. And that's just, I mean, he's got that problem in the comics as well. He's just, it's a limited sort of options in fights.
Okay.
That's just what it is.
So then they separate off and they have Kate has a face off with Kingpin, and Clint has his with Yelena. Let's talk about the Kingpin stuff first. So, yeah, I agree. It doesn't feel like the fight that has any thematic or, I guess it certainly there's nothing important between Kingpin and Kate other than her mum was working for him and wants to get out.
Yeah, but Kate doesn't care about that because Kate considers her mum a criminal. It's not like she's fighting to clear her mum's name or to get revenge for the things he made her do.
I think she doesn't want Kingpin to kill her mum, but I think the fight is more there for a let's put Kate up against the biggest villain in all of this and watch her just about hold her own. Except then she doesn't because she does get bailed out by her mum running through him with a car.
Yeah.
Is Kingpin indestructible? What's his vibe in the because he gets shot with an arrow and just carries on like Terminator like and then gets knocked through a wall by a car and gets up as well. So
I think he's been like a Spider-Man villain. Spider-Man who is, you know, got super strength. So I think in the comics he's just a big guy who's very strong for a human and he's just big and not fat, but he's just big. But yeah, stuff like that. You know, silly stuff like getting hit by an arrow in a car, like that. Exactly that sort of stuff happens in the comics. And it's you know, he's you buy it, and I thought I bought it in this.
Can I throw some silly Marvel speculation at you? So, on the one hand, he's Kingpin, he's a big fucker. It doesn't matter. It's the MCU. On the other hand, someone who's been accumulating wealth and power within New York and the MCU. Someone who's the head of this major organization who was interested in items that were recovered from the Avengers compound. Sharon Carter was on the phone to someone at the end of Falcon and the Winter Soldier selling stuff. Like, could that have been Kingpin? Could Kingpin have procured himself some of that secret blue serum that makes him super strong and indestructible?
No. I'd
know on that. Yeah, I'm sort of with Jay. Like, the fun of the character is, I think you can't give him superpowers, I think.
Yeah, because he hates superheroes. Like, that's sort of his thing.
Yes. I mean, could he have been on the phone to Sharon Carter? Sure. But, you know. So many question marks with all of this. You know, it's clear that, I think it's clear that D'Onofrio would like to continue to play Kingpin, you know, and he's got the right stature, not physical stature, but he's just about, he's the right level of a of the level of performance and the level of star that you could properly build stuff. You know, you could build a movie. He could be the villain in films. But, you know, I just wonder how far... I doubt that the character can be quite the same level of a supervillain that he is in the comics, based on, not, you know, based on D'Onofrio and the Netflix shows and also the kind of power set that he kind of has to have. I wonder. I don't, you know, the speculation that Kingpin will be the kind of a big bad in various Disney Plus New York based street level shows. I wouldn't be against it, but I think it's unlikely. I don't know what you guys think.
I think he's back. This to me has the feel of like okay, we got the contract done. You're in there, do this. Let's not be specific about anything, and then let's figure it all out later. I think D'Onofrio's back.
There is no chance we don't see him in the Echo show. Like 100%, he's back for that.
I'm just speculating to what degree he will be used going forward. That's all.
Yeah, I guess the question is he street level Thanos or is he a villain that turns up?
I thought
when he's useful.
Street level Thanos would be a good vibe, because that's the thing these shows are missing, is a real compelling reason to get invested in each one. Like if they were all facing similar threats and, you know, there were promises of a team up and stuff, I would get a sense of an evolving world around them in a way that I don't.
Just having flashbacks to the last time the Marvel street level characters had a team up in New York.
That was Netflix.
I just didn't get the vibe from him in this episode that he could be street level Thanos. I don't know if you guys disagree with that.
I do disagree with that, because I just did think it was just non-specific enough with what was going on around him, and because of the build-up that Clint had given him, which was like, even I don't want to mess with this guy.
Yeah,
I think the writing around him in the rest of the series convinced me of it more than the episode itself. And then the episode itself has just D'Onofrio being Kingpin, so that's enough. That's enough for me to think he can
be great. Yeah, I like the way they shoot him. Like, I think the way they, because obviously he can't be as physically big as he is depicted in the comics or even in Spider-Verse, but I love the way that I feel the way he's styled, the way he's shot. He's got a real kind of a real size to him. Yeah, I love all that stuff. The performance is fun.
Yeah,
yeah.
Meanwhile, Yelena is fighting Clint, and it's one of those classic. Here's what I think happened. And he said, no, here's what actually happened. Well, I'm going to punch you anyway. Okay. But what if our mums had the same name? Sorry, no. What if I whistled?
Uh-huh.
Then could we be friends? And
this was the bad version of the Martha thing.
It didn't make a huge amount of sense to me to begin with that Yelena would just blindly want to kill Hawkeye based on her sister being dead and why she would blame him. Again, I think this feels slightly confused in that she's hired to kill Clint and also she has personal
animals. And also wants to do it, yeah.
Yeah, so like I think kind of do one or the other. Have her turning up to fight Clint and then him having to maybe explain to her, no, don't you understand that I was your sister's best friend? And that it felt clunky, and the whistle felt like, again, shorthand of how do we breeze past this rather than actually having a proper referendum on whether... on whether Hawkeye does deserve some comeuppance. Because this is, as we are flashing between these two scenes, we are watching Eleanor Bishop, who, on the basis of killing one person, is, you know, rightfully arrested and is sent to atone for her crimes in prison. And Hawkeye, who killed a fuckload of people, who, in that scene, we are just being asked to go, but he's a good guy.
They were bad guys, though. That's the difference.
They wore tracksuits, Joe. They wore, and they were in a mafia.
Was Armand?
Why did she kill Armand? Do we know?
Because Kingpin sold her to. I think
probably. Asking too many questions.
Yeah. Sure. Poor Simon Callow.
Poor Simon Callow. Yeah.
So yeah,
he wasn't a clone. We didn't have clones in the end.
So I thought the Yelena Clint scene was a bit of a dud in the end. As much as I thought both of the actors tried to bring something to it, it was built on too shaky a ground for me to really pay off.
Yeah, you have. This is one of those sort of MCU things where, you know, what they're referencing are Hawkeye cutting the rope to Black Widow in the space, and she transforms her soul into something, and then on the other end of it, Yelena finding out at the end of a post-credit scene that happens. Yeah. Who can tell what after a movie that's a prequel being told by a character that we haven't met before that a thing happened that didn't really happen? And then, yeah, to Joe's point, it's like how are we as an audience supposed to kind of really smush all that together in our heads and our hearts in that moment? It is a stretch.
So, I guess the final moment from all of the fighting that we need to address is that Maya comes across Kingpin and appears to shoot him, but obviously doesn't kill him because Kingpin ain't dead.
Do you want a quick comics explainer there?
Yeah, go on.
In the comics, Kingpin gets shot in the face and it doesn't kill him, but it does blind him for a bit. Mm. Then he gets robot eyes, I believe. But you know, for a bit he's blind
because okay.
There's some synchronicity there between Daredevil and Echo.
Okay, right. Okay, yeah. That sounds silly.
I mean, that wouldn't be the first robot eye in a MCU character. That
absolutely
seen, so,
not.
You know, yeah. That has already been established. Rocket could just wander into Echo Episode 2 and hey, I got some eyes for you, Kingpin.
Some more butt eyes. So that's the setup, I guess, for Maya and that Echo series. There's a bit of japes with Jack talking to the LARPers. I really hope that's the last we see of that. Yeah, coming to Disney Plus in 2023. The LARPers.
Sportsman and the LARPers.
Grills Jack and the LARPers. And then there is
ten episodes.
A little bit of emotional catharsis for Clint and Kay. And this is kind of the only stuff that I ended up really caring about on an emotional level, was that relationship and him as a mentor and her as a kind of, you know, a fresh hero trying to prove herself, with him like holding a hand and saying he's proud of her. I was like, that's nice. That's just nice to hear him say, I'm proud of you. That's all I needed.
I think would work better if, like in the comics, he didn't have a nice relationship with like four of his own children. Yeah. Like that would you know, like, oh, he's learned to be a dad. No, he is a dad. Yeah. He already has a kid.
He's learned to be a super dad.
Yes.
I felt bad for his wife when they turn up at the farmhouse and he's like, yeah, just bought someone else extra for Christmas dinner. I was like, what, you couldn't have phoned?
Didn't make enough pigs in blankets.
I just thought it would be a funny surprise to bring someone back from
New York. I
assume
you weren't coming because you've changed your plans fucking 100 times this week. And now you show up and now there's fucking two of you. Thanks, dude. But thanks for my watch. Thank you.
So things are wrapped up with, she goes back to the Barton's farm for Christmas. We see that the watch belonged to Laura. She was S.H.I.E.L.D. Agent 19. So
maybe
she,
we don't know.
She was a
question mark.
She was a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. I guess it, you know, the stuff you were saying, James, about Mockingbird. Maybe, you know, maybe that's something that they could say later on, like, oh, she's Mockingbird. But I don't think it really matters. She is
no.
She was a S.H.I.E.L.D. agent. She's now retired. She's married to Clint. And if at some point they wanted to bring her back into the action, they could, or they could never talk about it again. It doesn't. I don't think it
matters. Or also, prequel series like Young Hawkeye and Young Laura.
No,
I'd watch that.
That's not happening.
I'd watch like When Harry Met Sally, like little
Mr. and Mrs. Barton.
Yeah, that'd be fun.
No, incorrect.
No.
Okay, I rescind.
They burn the Ronin suit. Let us never talk of it again. And
when that was happening, I was like, isn't this supposed to be like Kevlar or something?
Right.
You're just burning it.
Well, you didn't see the hour that they spent like trying to light it, like trying to pouring stuff on it. This damn thing just won't light.
And then they kind of walk off talking about what her superhero name is going to be. And she's thought of lots of ideas. And then Clint says, I've got a good idea for you. And we get the title card, which is Hawkeye. So she's Hawkeye now. They're both Hawkeyes. And that's nice. I'm glad that we're going to have Kate Bishop in the MCU. And
it's also fun. Can I also make a... I find it funny how many of these shows have ended, maybe not Loki, but ended with like, a reveal of a new character name and a new outfit for the character.
But like a like new
three of the four.
A new character name and a new outfit for the character that we knew already. Like, and now she's the Scarlet Witch. I know. And now she's Hawkeye. Yeah. She was from like
the Captain America the one. Start, was, right? Actually, that was building to, from the end of friggin' Endgame.
Yeah, at the end of Endgame, he gets given the shield, and they're like, "Oh, cool, he's Captain America now."
He's Captain America.
Not until episode 6.
Yes, he must go do a therapy first with the robot boy.
And this was the episode where he truly did become Loki for the first time. And then we get to the post-credit sequence, and the first slice of canonical MCU that I haven't watched.
I watched the whole thing expecting a punchline.
I couldn't.
There wasn't a punchline.
I couldn't do it.
Yeah, I didn't watch it.
I couldn't do it. It was. I thought. I just. It made me want to claw out my eyes and ears.
I was genuinely expecting there to be someone sitting in the audience. Like genuinely, I was expecting Bruce Banner to be sitting there going like, I thought Hawkeye was coming. Where's Clint?
Yeah.
But no, it was just the song. That was just a little treat for us.
I would say, I think it is very well earnestly done in the way it was intended. And I think the people, you know, who were responsible for the song and that were performing it
should be sent to the Hague.
No, I think they should be. I think they should be proud of themselves for doing a kind of a cheesy Broadway style superhero thing that did have me kind of thinking about Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark and that,
Turn Off the Dark. Yeah.
I can't get that David Letterman clip out of my mind when Letterman has to walk onto the stage and be like, "You're the Liz." What? So this is not me saying it's bad. It's just me saying I couldn't watch it.
Yeah, fair.
Okay, so guys, kind of broad takes on the series and hopes, expectations for what comes next. Do you think we get a series 2 of Hawkeye in any kind of way, or do you think the question is where do we see these characters next that isn't a Hawkeye series?
Hawkeye season 2, Brian D'Arcy James, Kate Bishop, no Renner in LA. I think that happens.
Yeah, I think that happens before we see Kate in a movie. But I think Renner cameo. That's the only difference.
Well, because
I think Renner's the one on the phone this time.
Yeah.
I mean, what was I going to say? It's these characters are all going to be in an Avengers or a Young Avengers or a Thunderbolts or a Dark Avengers or whatever, but you know, we sort of know the slate now for the next 2 or 3 years, and that isn't on the slate. So
yeah, so they've got to keep them ticking over somewhere.
I think they're going to be in these shows for a little bit before they, but there will be a movie with these characters in it for sure.
I really want the shows to get better because I'm not having a lot of fun watching them at the moment.
I kind of thought that this was, as a series, fine week to week. Like I said, I really enjoyed episode 3. And otherwise, I was like, this is okay. I certainly wasn't having the frustrations that I was with Falcon and the Winter Soldier and Loki. But it's certainly not... I don't think I would be rushing to watch these shows weekly at the moment if it weren't for the podcast.
That's the thing, right? If these were DC shows, I would have dropped off them.
I think, to be honest, I think I'd still be watching them because of my MCU you know, buy in.
Yeah, I'd be binge watching them at the end.
Yes, that's probably what I'd be doing. Certainly with Hawkeye, but I definitely didn't feel that way with WandaVision. But yeah, we've got, I mean, coming up, we've got Moon Knight. That's the thing, though, is I'm still kind of like, I'm looking at what they've got coming up, and like Moon Knight with Ethan Hawke and Oscar Isaac, She-Hulk with Tatiana Maslany, Secret Invasion, which feels like it's going to be like an event series almost on TV, Ms. Marvel. Like, yeah, I still am, because of the residual interest in these characters, and I'm still bought in on all of those shows. But yeah, I do understand your...
Moon Knight's going to suck. I just think, and that's going to be the last
it's
one.
It's going to be so bad.
I think it's going to be terrible, and we're going to go, oh no, oh no. I think there's a chance it's terrible. Based on, I mean, nothing really, but...
Okay, and
anyway.
and are we 100% that Kate Bishop and or Clint Barton, but I think more likely Kate Bishop, don't turn up in any of these movies that are on the slate? We've got Doctor Strange in the Multiverse of Madness. I would say no. Thor, Love and Thunder?
Nah.
No.
No, that movie's stacked already.
Wakanda Forever?
No chance.
No. The Marvels?
Possibly.
Possibly, yeah.
Just because she's a female hero rather than any...
Well, because...
Well, also, Ms. Marvel's based in New Jersey, right? Like, she's in New Jersey. She's in the Young... She'll be in the Young Avengers.
Okay, right, yeah, okay.
Maybe she's their friend.
Guardians of the Galaxy Volume 3 feels like a no. Ant-Man and the Wasp, Quantumania.
That one you could maybe see. You could see her, because obviously Catherine Newton has, you know, stature.
Yeah.
You know, Hawkeye and Ant-Man have a sort of dynamic. I can actually, that's likely.
Yeah, I think that's top of my list as to where she shows up on screen, if not
and then,
in the Marvels.
And then Fantastic Four.
Nah.
Who knows what the fuck that movie is. this is too far. Yeah.
Listen,
Blade.
She's going to be in Blade for sure.
Based on...
Blade. She shoots little blades.
I've got to say, I'm a lot more excited for Fantastic Four after No Way Home, but we'll get to that discussion.
Okay. And then I feel like the next time we see Yelena is probably when Kate Bishop calls her up, right? To be like, oh, hey, I know someone who might be useful for the team. Because again, I don't really see like a natural point to slot her in. The only established characters in the MCU that she really has anything to do with is Kate Bishop now. So that's probably her way into you.
It's tough, isn't it? Because it feels like, why would you set these characters up and then leave them fallow for 2-3 years?
Yeah, there must be
more TV stuff incoming.
Well, TV, or you're right, maybe like a supporting turn kind of in one of those other movies.
I can imagine Secret Invasion being like
bringing everyone into it.
One episode guest appearance for Yelena or for Kate.
Yeah.
You know, Nick Fury is the spine around the whole thing. And maybe, you know, a Secret / New Avengers team at the end.
Yeah, I could see. And again, you could see those characters showing up in some capacity in Ms. Marvel or Ironheart, maybe, you know, with those younger characters as well. So, yeah, hopefully we do see them again soon. And, yeah, I think I'd be more interested in a Hawkeye season 2 that is full...
Full Kate, yeah.
Full Kate than this vibe again. And just because I think... That's for me. That should be Renner's role now, which is kind of the guy on the farm that you call up, rather than someone who is actively a major part of any of these films or shows.
Yeah, I think so.
Cool. Okay, so that was Hawkeye. We will wait on the Patreon for the next Disney Plus show to turn up, which I think is probably Moon Knight, we think. But hasn't been announced as of yet. And then obviously on the main feed, we will be getting our end of year Cuppies Awards. We'll be coming to you soon. And then also Spider-Man that we need to catch up on. So lots of exciting stuff coming your way in the next couple of weeks/months. And that's it for this week's episode. if you if you're listening on Patreon, thanks for listening already. If you would like to get all of this and all of the back content, head to patreon.com/cinematicuniverse. You can subscribe to us at $3 a month and get all of these bonus weekly episodes. We also went through the Hawkeye comic book series, which was a huge amount of fun, so do check those out if you haven't already. You can subscribe on the main feed on your podcast app of choice. If you want to find us online, we are at @Cine_verse on Twitter. I'm at @JoeCunningham14. James is at James Hunt, and Reese is at Reese. We will be back, very shortly, depending on how quickly I see Spider-Man, either with the Cuppies first or Spider-Man No Way Home first. It's going to be a surprise. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you then.
Goodbye.